Welcome to today's episode of The Halal Gap. I'm your host, Sophia Alani, and today I am joined by...
your other host, Sikandar Atik.
And today we have a new guest behind the mic. Sana, where are you at?
Woo!
Hi!
Awesome. We're really excited about today's guest. Take it away, Sikandar.
He's an actor, a writer, a stand-up comedian, and the proud owner of one of the sweetest mustaches I've ever seen. You may know him best for his work as a writer on Netflix's Patriot Act, for his incredible stand-up sets that he's performed in everything from Jimmy Kimmel Live to Bill Burr's The Ringers, or for his recurring role in Ahmed's Ramadan Diary with Ahmed Weinberg. Joining us from, actually, I don't know where you are right now, but we'll find that out very soon. Please welcome to the podcast, Ismail Lutfi.
Woo-hoo!
What's up?
Where are you, actually? I know you were doing a bit of a road trip.
Are you back in New
York? Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's okay. Yeah, we were gone. We were in Atlanta and Naples, Florida, but now I'm back in Brooklyn.
Okay, so, right on.
Yeah.
back in the epicenter. Although
back in the epicenter.
New York is, you know, you guys have done a good job of getting things back under control, I feel. Like from a COVID perspective.
Maybe. I don't know. I think we're about to be going through a second wave like everyone else, because right outside my door of my apartment, there's like a restaurant with a bunch of people eating like without masks. God. So I'm like I'm watching the second wave develop right in front of me. And we're just like, well, that's...
Man.
Yeah, we're taking it very seriously, though.
No, that's...
me and the
that's
wife, good. Yeah.
What was it like doing a road trip during COVID? Like, were there any differences? Was it pretty regular?
I think it was interesting to see what places, like, just based on pit stops, like, what places were taking it really seriously and what places weren't. Because... I think like in Virginia, everybody, like where we stopped, everyone was wearing a mask. But for some reason in Delaware, everybody was like just coughing on each other and shit. Like nobody cared. People were acting like it was fine in Delaware. And then we're my wife's dad lives in Naples. Everyone is the same thing. Everybody is just walking around like nothing is going on. People are treating it like there's
Florida's
not
wild,
a pandemic.
Man.
Florida is insane. It's really sad.
Yeah, yeah. Especially, like, I mean, not to generalize, but, like, obviously there's a lot more of an elderly population in Florida. Like,
yeah.
You would think that they would be a little more cautious, but I don't know.
It's got, like, Quranic, biblical vibes really heavily. How people are just not heeding the warnings. People are like, no, it's not real. It's not real. And they're the people most vulnerable, like these old rednecks and these old conservatives who just like, God, it's real sad.
It is wild. Like, honestly, I have some like more heavily right-leaning people still on my Instagram, which I'm like teetering to the point of like,
oh, wow.
Is it time to finally just like block this person or not? But
2020, man.
Yeah, no. But you keep them around. They're like emotionally they're canceled. But like just on a general level, I just like to see it, just to see what the other side likes to say and promote. And it is like truly a farce to them. Like they actually think this is a giant like propaganda
hoax.
Machine. Yeah, it's like a hoax. And it's like, what? I don't understand. Anyway.
Yeah. It's real scary. It's real. It makes me feel good about my faith. Just that like, even with science, people will be like, no, we don't believe, you know, it's like, I don't know. Sorry if I took a really serious turn there.
No. You go where you gotta go, man. No.
Yeah.
But, we've all been doing that kind of deep reflecting right now because one, there's nothing else to do,
totally.
But also
literally nothing
of the context. So have you, like, other than this road trip, what have your quarantine things, your quarantine life been like?
God, pretty bland, truly. I mean, I feel like the worst thing is just that that's like the only thing we can talk about. That's like, it's so annoying that's like the only thing that we can talk about with each other just as a race right now
it's
of
so
humans.
True.
It's like, that's going to be That's going to be the most annoying part about like the apocalypse. Actually, it's just that there's not going to be
boring.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, oh, what are we going to talk about? Oh, maybe the lake that's on fire everywhere. Like, there's not any other things that are going to be interesting to people. It's just real. It's real boring.
Yeah.
I don't know. Well, I mean, I don't want to take too seriously, but at the beginning of the quarantine, my dad actually died. So
I know.
I'm going to make it real sad, but there's no other way to talk about it. So it was just real sad for the first couple months. It was in like March. So anyway, just a lot of grieving, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And yeah. And then, I mean, now I'm starting to feel better and I'm starting to write again. And yeah. All right.
Well, no, no.
Nice talking to you guys.
okay. Let's, I mean, no, I'm incredibly sorry to hear that, but
yeah, I'm sorry for your loss.
But let's try to maybe pivot into happier topics if we can. We can get back to that. I'm not trying to ignore his grief.
Oh, wow. My goodness. Wow.
Sophia's a lot better at that part of the equation than I am. So, Sophia, if you want to take over a grief counseling.
Well, no. Grief counseling. Yeah, this whole new vision for the podcast. Yeah. No, but I just wanted to, I'm so sorry for your loss. Was that really hard to, like, do that? Like, I don't know if everything was already shut down when that happened, but were you able to be with family and everything?
It was really insane. It was very bleak because, so basically Patriot Act, we're all like working and, okay, so first let me preface by saying January and February 2020 were awesome for me. Like they were the best months. Like I got married and Patriot Act was going well and I got into the Comedy Cellar. I was like doing a million shows. Everything was amazing. And yeah, like just living out so many dreams suddenly. And then like in the middle of March, Patriot Act, like we all started working from home for like a week. And then one day we all got an email that was like, guys, we're indefinitely shutting down because like we can't do the show from home right now for some reason. We have to like figure out a schedule. We have to make it like safe for the camera crew or whatever. Like it has to be a very organized methodology that needs to be implemented. So for the time being, you're all unemployed. And I was like, what? Like it felt very real suddenly that like shit's stopping, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then like 2 hours later, I got a call that my dad died. So it was just kind of like, oh shit. And of course, stand up is gone. Like it's illegal now.
Right.
So it was just kind of like everything I had like disappeared and it was just replaced with my dad being dead, which was brutal, but you know,
was it sudden or was it something that you
it
guys
was
were
long, no,
it, preparing it, for?
Yeah, no, he had kidney disease. So he had been kind of going for a long time, for a few years, just like getting sicker, which is really sad. But I don't know. It would have been a lot easier to handle with, of course, like my livelihood. You know what I mean?
Right. With some, not distractions, but just, you know,
honestly, distractions certainly things like that would have been really nice to have. It would have been nice to like not have to think about it for you know, an hour, every night for 1 hour, just be able to like do a different thing or even process it on stage. Like I totally would have been able to do that. Like I probably could have, I know this is extremely selfish and such a comedian thing to say, but I probably could have developed a bit about the grief or something, you know, but like, no, that was also just kind of like gone. And so, it was pretty rough for a while there.
It's interesting because, I read somewhere that, you know, your first introduction to stand up was also born out of a traumatic experience that you went through. Mm. Has comedy always been sort of that outlet for you to express your emotions, or was it more of a distraction at that time and it's since blossomed into something more, or can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think a lot of comics do this. but it's definitely been that way for me. It's definitely been a thing that, like something terrible will happen to me. And then, you know, 3 weeks later, it'll be like a nice 3 minute joke that I could put in the act. It might not be healthy. I think it's probably very damaging, to my mental well-being to sort of commodify my sadness like that. But I don't know. I think it does help, you know, I think it does, at least in the short term, help.
I was going to say, is it damaging? Cause I feel like that's like such a good way to like process and turn it into something a little more like productive. I don't know if that's the right word, but like, it kind of seems like that's like a dope outlet that you have.
That's the thing. It is not unhealthy as long as stand-up is allowed to be done. But as soon as it gets taken away, then it's like, oh wow, I put all of my mental health eggs in a basket that is now spreading disease, you know? So it's not good now.
It's good until there's a pandemic, and then it's
which I think we've learned has really just shaken every single thing up, unfortunately.
Oh no, go ahead. Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was just gonna say that's been the awkward thing. This is the first kind of public format where I've mentioned that my dad died, because it's just been, it's a shitty time to have a thing happen, you know?
Like, totally.
It's really hard to be like, well, this happened to me in the midst of, you know, 200,000 people dying, and plus Black Lives Matter. It's like, there's so many things going on that are sort of pinned in sadness and anger that it feels really weird to like take up space and be like, well, hi, I'm a comedian and you know, renal failure, it's a real bitch, you know? Like, it just feels like random. Like, I have not been able, I haven't told anybody really, so other than close friends and shit. Yeah.
It's one of those things where, you know, I've been having a lot of conversations with people about this as well, about how, you know, I feel like right now we're in this context where only giant, like, global issues matter. And it's like, at the same time, I mean, at the same time, we can't forget that, like, you know, individual issues also matter and individual wins also matter, you know? So like I know so many people who are like, oh, you know, my show got picked up or this, that, and the other thing. And it's like, but they feel bad celebrating it. And like, that's the other side of the equation where it's like, you know, because all these other things are happening that we feel like our own issues or our own wins aren't as successful. But I think it's really important to still be able to both celebrate and to grieve even things that we might be going through that everybody else isn't going through. So bottom line, I appreciate you sharing that, man. I mean, we're very, very sorry to hear it.
Thanks for not being weird about it, really. I questioned whether or not I should mention it.
Not at all, of course.
But then I listened to some episodes and I was like, oh, you guys are okay with going a little deep here and there, so
it'll
be fine. You won't shut down.
that's what you gleaned from the other episode.
There you go. Have you ever listened to Mark Maron's podcast, like WTF with Mark Maron?
Yeah.
So I don't know if you heard his one with Seinfeld where
I just listened to it.
So remember how they were like kind of going back and forth about how, you know, pain and comedy are on, you know, opposite sides of the same coin. Mark's like a big believer in that, right? Where there's like this very fine line between like pain and comedy. And Seinfeld's like, no, like, what the hell are you talking about? Like, your job is to make people laugh and that's it. Like, don't bring your personal shit into this. Like, it is what it is. What, like, do you have any thoughts on that? Like, do you buy that idea that there's like this fine line between pain and comedy? Or are you more of the opinion that like, no, my job is to make people laugh and I'm going to do that from a place of happiness and that's that?
Right. I think that Mark and Seinfeld in that they kind of were just agreeing and they didn't know it, because Maron's whole thing is that, you know, comedy should come from this dark place, and Seinfeld's thing is that it shouldn't. Right. But I think Seinfeld's dark place is those observations. I think his like sadness or whatever is his really mundane kind of banal observational corny comedy, like which when you think about it is very sad in a way that you could be so dedicated to picking apart such minute things in the world. Like, I don't know. I think they're both really depressed, probably. I agree with what Marin is saying more. Like, I think comedy does require some trauma and some sad things. But then the thing Seinfeld is saying is just that it has to be funny. So they're kind of just agreeing. They just want to pretend like they're not. So there's drama, which is what comedians love. Yeah, we love to pretend that there's drama in the comedy world when there's not.
It's like we're all agreeing, but we're still going to argue about it.
Yes, exactly. Yeah,
that's
exactly.
Like me and Sikander all of the time.
Yeah, yeah. 100%.
So I just to kind of bring it back, because I know we did that awesome intro, especially love that we mentioned the mustache, because please go into detail about that later. But like you, I don't know that our listeners really know that much about you, like how you got started and stuff. So can you kind of give us a little background on how, like, who are you? Where did you grow up? Where were you born? Like, what would you like to share with our listeners?
So what's going on, guys? Just talking to you guys right now. How you doing? Salam. How's your quarantine going? Comedian. I started comedy like 9 years ago when I was 18. After I got divorced from my wife.
At 18?
In Florida. Yeah. It was dope. It was really sick. I feel like I'm testing you guys just as a format and as a show. I'm good with it. You guys. Anyway, so after the first abortion, you know, comedy really kind of took off. And No. I'm a comedian from Florida. Muslim. My father is Syrian. Mother is a convert, American white lady. And I don't know. I just was doing comedy in the South in Florida and Georgia for a long time, and then moved to LA, was doing comedy there. LA sucks. And then alhamdulillah, I got the writing job for Hasan Minhaj when the show first started. And I've been in New York ever since. So that's kind of the very, very brief explainer to the uninitiated.
I have so many questions. I guess first, so Florida, I know that like in creeping your Instagram, you posted a few things about like your hometown and how it seems to be quite anti-Muslim. And like, what was that like growing up there? And like, has that shaped the way that you address your faith and your comedy?
I think so. I'm from Ocala, which is in central Florida, and it's just like a horse town, super redneck. But to be honest with you, I was like a lot of, you know, children of immigrants and sort of Muslim Americans. I was very secluded, and I just kind of didn't mess around with like regular Ocalan people. So I kind of didn't see a lot of the, you know, racism I probably would have, and a lot of the hate, even though it's definitely around. It's just like in your periphery, no matter what you do, like there's going to be a Confederate flag or somebody with like some shitty bumper sticker, and you know, signs for businesses that have like weird kind of hateful messages on them.
What's the shittiest bumper sticker you've ever seen?
The shittiest bumper sticker I ever saw? God, that's a good question. I mean, I don't know if you know this about Florida, but Florida is all about like signage that is abrasive. Like if you're driving into Florida from Georgia, the billboards are like insane. It's every comedian in Florida has like 30 minutes of hacky billboard jokes about like just all these billboards that are like, do you know where you're gonna go when you die? Yeah, they're huge, and there's images of the devil, and there's I mean, like Westboro Baptist churchy energy around everything. I'm trying to think of the worst bump. I mean, it's funny that you mentioned bumper stickers, because my dad was actually like the most, like, this is a tangent, but I think it's interesting. He like decked out his car. He had this blue Pontiac, and he painted all over it, like Islamic messages. And
why is that on your Instagram, man? Holy.
Honestly, because I've never thought about, like, it never felt like the right time. Like, I always was like, I don't want to, like, waste this thing. I don't want to do it.
And,
like, it gets 150 likes, and then, like, I move on. And, you know what I mean?
No.
I want to make a documentary about this
cover.
Shit. You know
that's
what I mean?
An album cover for
thank
sure.
You.
Oh, yeah, or a documentary for sure.
On the back of the card, it says IslamAlways.com. I don't know if you know Yusuf Estes. Do you know Yusuf Estes?
I'm going to that website right now. I don't. No.
No.
Oh, he's this Texan imam who's like.
Okay.
Who my dad like didn't like that much, but like liked enough that he took the name of the website and put it on his car. And
quite a bit of liking. That's a commitment.
That's a
funny
thing.
Doing research on it right now.
He was just kind of like trying to front, like he just wanted to like show off that he really was going above and beyond for the dawah. You know what I mean? Like, I mean, he even went to the website. He just liked the name.
That's awesome. I love that. That's also being done in like the context of the city and town in which you lived in. Right. It's like, no, not only am I Muslim, I'm like so Muslim that I'm going to like put it all over my car and make sure all of you racist mofos can see it.
Yes.
That's a flex right there.
He was flexing all the time, and he always wanted to drive the furthest he could. Like, he was like, I want to go to the furthest Sam's Club. I want to go to the furthest, you know, Publix, or I don't know if you have Publix, probably not.
We have just those stores, but they're both great. I know it.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Publix is amazing. But he would always just want to go as far as he could so that he could drive the car as throughout as much of Florida and Ocala as he could to just show off.
Was it dangerous driving around in a car like that? Like, were there ever any scary things that happened?
That's what I mean by like being secluded. Like, I drove in that car all the time, and I just kind of like kept my eyes on the road. Like, I didn't, like, I knew people were flipping us off, and I just like didn't really notice. Like, I didn't care really. Because my dad didn't take it seriously. He thought it was really funny when people would get mad.
That's such a good way to handle it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, awesome.
Totally. And also, I mean, he was asking for it, like that. It wasn't just Islam Always. He had all kinds of messages on it, like Jesus never said worship me or my blood. Stop lying to your children. Buddhism is atheism. Like, I'm not even kidding. Like, he had like all kinds of messages, taking shots at everyone around. Even if like there was a Buddhist nearby, he made sense in the context of Florida. Like, people were like, yeah, that's, I feel like he didn't get as much shit as he would have if he was in like Pennsylvania or something, because people in Florida are just sort of like, yeah, be mean. That's our thing.
Do you think he's gonna be like fully committed? So it wasn't, he was like half-assed, like, no, like, Islam is cool too. He's like, listen, all of you, I'm coming for all of you. And then Florida was like, yeah, okay. That's
respect,
how we do it here.
Yeah. Mutual respect.
Okay. Yeah.
Exactly. Yes. I mean, we lived 30 minutes from, do you remember the guy who burned the Quran? Like, it made it, he was like his big thing.
Yeah. I remember that.
We're like right next to that guy. Like, I went to college, like, right by that dude. So it's just a very inflamed kind of state, I guess. But anyway, I definitely picked up a lot of like comedic instincts from his kind of mania, or whatever you want to call it. Like,
no, yeah. Fair enough. You know, it's interesting because when you talk to a lot of like comics, Muslim comedians specifically, they kind of like, you know, not to generalize, but a lot of them have very specific material that's like for a Muslim audience, or they have like a material that's like much more broad based. But I remember the first time I saw you was a couple of years ago. You did a show when Rami was doing his like Friends of Rami thing in Brooklyn, preparing for his set. You did a show, and it was like a very non-Muslim audience. And it was the first time I heard your entire like Uber driver bit, and I'm like, oh my God, this guy is like killing it, and like killing it in front of like a non-Muslim audience, but with like with humor that's very much inspired by his faith. And I was like, man, this is like one of the first times I'd ever seen that, where it's like, yes, I'm like unabashedly Muslim, and like my content is going to be derived from my lived experience, but it's also very relatable to a broad non-Muslim audience. Is that something that you were like, very consciously have developed over time, or has that just kind of been a welcome reception to your experiences?
I think it developed unconsciously over the years, because starting in Florida when I was a teenager, a lot of my comedy, like at first, my first things that I was talking about were very like basic. Like I was trying to talk about being single, and I was trying to talk about not drinking alcohol, because those were like the two most No, that's what I'm saying though. I wasn't trying to be halal. I was trying to like talk about just like being a regular person who for some reason doesn't drink and for some reason isn't getting laid a bunch. You know what I mean? In the city I went to college, which was like a big party town, Gainesville. So like I kind of like tried not to talk about being a Muslim and just tried to talk about my very bizarre, unique experience as a brown guy with a weird name who kind of has these like practices, you know what I mean? Until one day I did like a Muslim joke, and then it like did really well, whereas before I was bombing, you know, terribly. And then I kind of realized like, oh, you can like talk about being a Muslim and people are really interested in it. And I guess the reason I'm saying that is that at first my Muslim material was kind of like pandery a little bit, and a little bit like, oh, you know, terrorist jokey and making fun of like the Middle East and stuff like that. And it kind of morphed into being a little bit more honest to how I feel over 10 years, you know what I mean? Because I was aware that like, you know, if I went to New York, if I went to LA at that point in my career and I was doing jokes that were like kind of like basically for rednecks, that it wouldn't play well, you know? So it sort of like developed over time as I got more comfortable with it. So yeah, I guess that's it.
And so do you feel like the audience you had in front of you played a lot into that, or was that like a more internal choice to be like more authentic in speaking more authentically about your life experiences?
I think the audience, of course, is the biggest thing. I mean, this is why I agree with Seinfeld a lot in what he was saying, is that like, you know, you could go on stage and be really true to yourself, and the truth to yourself is just probably not going to be very funny. So you have to learn how to be true to yourself and have it be funny. So when I first started, I was less concerned with being true to myself because it just wouldn't have been very funny at the time, and I was more concerned with just getting laughs. And you know, as audiences kind of became more liberal, I think it did have to do with audiences like getting more woke in general. We kind of grew together in a weird way where like now I have like a pretty good vibe, like when I see a crowd, like I can sense very quickly how far they're willing to go with me in some Muslim material and how far they're, you know, like how tight they're going to be about certain things. So I don't know.
Yeah. It's
crowds are important.
I mean, for sure. And I think like before, like it reminds me of, I think it was here's the thing. We don't get the Ringers in Canada, which is unfortunate. And it's like almost impossible to find online, but I think I found it. And I think I saw your set. It must have been that one. I'm assuming it's that one, but you like open being like, you know, I'm Muslim. Are there any Muslims in the crowd? And it was like dead silence. and like that can go two ways, right? That could go into like people being mad awkward, or it can go into like, you know, what happened, which was like everybody burst into laughter because they were like, oh shit, we don't have any Muslims here, but like we're on board to like learn about this dude who's like, you know, coming out and saying it. So no, it makes sense that like the audience is also evolving to a point where they're much more receptive to that.
For sure. That was so funny because like every time I took a big risk with that, because I was kind of doing like a hacky joke in that moment where what I wanted to do is I wanted to go, any Muslims here? 90% of the time there will be one Muslim in the crowd who will clap. 90% of the time somebody will go woo, right? So I was like banking on that. And this is how the joke would go. And I don't know if I stand by it, but I was doing it at the time. It was taped a year ago. So, I mean, you know how far we've come so quickly. But the joke is just like, any Muslims here? woo, somebody shouts. And then I go, haha, cool, now. And so the joke is like that we're going to blow up the menu. And it does really well. It does well because people, like, people kind of feel uncomfortable and they laugh at it.
Because I can't quite tell how serious you are.
Exactly, exactly. And then it gets a big laugh and then I go, ha, just kidding. Now, I like do it again. But that was so funny because I was like, any Muslims here? And there was just no one. And I just had to go, all right, never mind. That bit is just not going to happen, I guess.
Oh my God. That's too funny.
Yeah, it really sucked, but it worked out. It was fine. People laughed.
You should just have a plant at this point, just to make right, sure.
You need really a token Muslim in the crowd.
Yeah.
Just have somebody in there. That'd be great.
One Muslim you always bring with you.
That would be, I should start doing that. you don't get ringers even on YouTube in Canada?
No, so it's blocked on YouTube in Canada, but I found it on, I think like the Ringer's Facebook uploaded it or Comedy Central Facebook uploaded it. So I found it there, but it was not, you know, it's funny because I had a similar conversation with Rami when he launched his show on Hulu and it wasn't available in Canada. He was like, dude, just download it illegally. So if you listen to our podcast with Rami, which was our first episode of this thing, he's telling everybody to illegally download it. So I don't know if you want to say that about the Ringers, but...
Download it illegally. I mean, Comedy Central, like, they have such a hard... They have a terrible, like, streaming services. They don't allow people to see anything. It's kind of crazy.
There's a lot of paywalls involved, yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Totally.
But anyway, talking about a show that anybody can watch, though, on Netflix, you, as we mentioned, you're a key part of the Patriot Act team, which congratulations, yeah. By the way, you guys have had amazing success year over year over year.
Mm-hmm.
But like, I find that show is in such a unique position as it relates to COVID because, you know, a lot of these late night shows and a lot of comedy shows were able to very easily adapt to just being like this digital format where, you know, it's just it's like the host in their home and it's good to go. But you guys rely so heavily on like amazing production value as part of the show. So how hard was it to adapt that format because of like the new kind of COVID reality?
Well, I'm just a writer, so
I'm assuming like even from a writing perspective, like did you guys have to think visually or is that typically part of the routine or what?
No, for sure. We always every graphic in there, all the cool graphics and the splashes and stuff are written by us. So we do write them, but we don't have to, of course, you know, program them or animate them or anything like that. So on that end, it didn't change too much. It just changed like we couldn't write in crazy graphics. We couldn't like, I'm trying to think of something that we've done in the past. Like, I'm drawing a blank. I don't know, but we've done some crazy graphics on the show and we couldn't write that kind of thing in. Mm-hmm. God, it sucks that I can't think of an example. but other than that, for us, it was okay. For the show itself though, they had to move the whole studio. It's kind of crazy. They moved to Connecticut. Like Hassan did. I don't know if I'm allowed to say this stuff. Hopefully he doesn't hear it.
No, I think he's saying that publicly.
Available. Yeah, okay. Yeah, he has said it. So he moved to Connecticut, and then the head writer, who's like his best friend, also moved to Connecticut, and Netflix wouldn't let them like make the show unless it was just the two of them in the room. So basically our head writer had to like set up the camera, do all the like editing and production of like on the spot, like all the shooting, all the edits and takes and cuts and stuff, along with like writing all the episodes, you know, the majority of them. So it was pretty hard for him, but for us, we just kind of like, we sat back and just kind of like waited for them to figure it out and you know, just had a great time waiting. Yeah. And then, and I'll be honest with you, I do think Patriot Act looks amazing, even with COVID. Like, I think it still looks pretty good.
Totally.
100%.
Considered.
Yeah, it doesn't give off like a cheesy green screen effect at all.
No,
like,
it's very impressive.
Yeah. Our graphics team is insane. Like, I do not know how they do everything.
Totally. No, and I mean, like, the other part of that, like, question, I guess, is more, much more relevant to you guys, in that I'm assuming, and again, this is just based off of like what you had mentioned in terms of, you know, you guys were working hard in January, February. I'm assuming you guys had a lot of content that you wanted to cover this year, but obviously had to shift dramatically when COVID hit. And of course, you know, Black Lives Matter started to gain steam once again, as it rightfully should. Right. Were you guys constantly in a state of like writing and rewriting and rewriting and rewriting, or what was that process like?
Yeah, that was, we're in an interesting position because I think every other late night show they do their episodes like with not too much advance. Like they're writing the, like last week tonight, he'll have some pieces that have been like well produced and researched for months and months in advance. But I think on the whole, people do their episodes like 2 weeks, 3 weeks notice, you know. Our show needs like several months to like be set up, you know, because the graphics are like a huge just swinging thing that has to be pinned to the right moment, that he's like talking and the jokes have to make sense. Like everything is so interconnected with the content that COVID like actually did screw up a bunch of stuff. Like we had taped two episodes, I'm pretty sure, prior to the shutdown, prior to everything shutting down. We had like banked two episodes that were like done in front of a live studio audience that it had nothing to do with the pandemic that was ravaging the country, that, you know, and we just had to basically throw them away and rewrite them. And I don't know if you've noticed, but every single episode starts with some caveat about COVID-19. Like every episode, and this is true of John Oliver too, but every episode starts out with like, you know, COVID-19 is ruining the world. Anyway, that's why I want to talk about taxes. And then it's like about taxes somehow. But like that was like the big lift on the writer's end, is like, how do we make, you know, whatever, an episode, local news relate to COVID-19? Which, right. I mean, it's not that hard. It's so ubiquitous that it's like, yeah, you can plug it into anything and it makes sense.
Yeah. Also, that taxes episode was so dope. I sent that link to every family member and friend I have in the U.S. I was like, file for free here.
I think that it's super important, that one. Like, yeah. That like actually will affect people's lives, which is really cool.
And especially during COVID with like such high unemployment and like people just like it was so relevant. Like that's, it's so funny how you're like, taxes, what's that? But like, you're like, no, this is so, so on point right now.
Right. True.
Yeah. No, it's funny because it's funny that you mentioned that it literally takes you guys months and months to produce one episode. I remember before Patriot Act came on, and you were probably in the room, I just didn't know who you were at that time, but Hussein would do these like trial runs at Fat Black Pussycat in New York.
I love those. So
they were awesome. I think I saw the affirmative action episode like four times being worked on.
So funny. Yeah.
And seeing like that transformation from like, you know, the first kind of week in which he did it to like the week leading up to Patriot Act was wild, right? And to see that like the production value start to increase on like even the graphics was insane. Right. So is it still that iterative of a process, or is it now like, okay, you guys know, here's the formula, here's the production, plug in a topic, write it to make it relevant and go?
Damn, I had a Google iterative relating to or involving iteration. Sorry, dude, I'm from Florida, man. We're not, our parents didn't all move to Edmonton. We're not all smarties.
rewrite a lot.
Let me see. Okay. Computational process.
Damn, dude. All right. The question, basically, you get the gist.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness.
I think the process has it's gotten smoother, but it's basically the same as it was. Like it's just, you know, research is like a wing of the show that's doing their thing, and they're always being silly and I don't know. It's basically all the same that it was, I'd say, except that we're
still doing like multiple versions of the same episode over and over and over again until you guys feel like
that's what you're saying. Yeah, yeah. No, totally, totally. Unfortunately, that is still, I think, a part of the process that is like annoying. But I don't think it's I think we're all just like better at dealing with it emotionally. Because you know, you write rough draft and then you turn it in, and then by the end of the process it's like what is this even about, you know? It's so different. Not to say it's bad, but it's like it's a different product than what you kind of slaved over initially.
And do you feel like that's like increased your skills as a writer to like become more succinct or to like get to the joke, the point quicker? Like, has that helped?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, for sure. I'm very appreciative. Like, I shit on Patriot Act a lot just with friends and stuff. But like, truly, like how much of a pain it can be. I think everyone probably does that works on it. It's just, can be a hard job, right? But it has definitely improved my abilities to like write and be cynical and critical of myself and kind of like be able to write a thing knowing that it's not going to be what I'm writing in the moment, you know, like have that sort of like, you know, bird's eye view of it and be able to create something and not like not be disheartened knowing that it's not going to be the same. I think it's a huge part of writing anything creatively because it's just all going to be edited, you know, no matter what you do. Nobody writes something perfect in the first shot or ever really.
Was that hard to deal with? Because I know that like a lot of the writers I know, so like not comedy writers, or a lot of the writers I know are quite perfectionists. Like they're very much like it's really hard for them to go through that editing and rewriting process because they're like, the first thing needs to be perfect. And if it not, that means I'm a failure. And I imagine it's relatively similar with comedy because like that's you telling your own story and it's like something that is coming like from such an authentic place. And then you're like, if I can't land it the first time, like is that hard? I imagine it would be hard.
I don't think it's very hard. Like you're saying, is it hard to write something and have it not land the first time?
Yeah, or like is it like was it hard to kind of get used to that idea? Because you mentioned like it's easier now to be like critical of yourself and to realize that like the thing you write first draft is not going to be where it ends up. And so was it like hard to get used to that fact and like that go through the process and not be like, I'm not going to take this personally?
Oh yeah. No, it's very difficult. It was at first like devastating to write a thing and have a whole chunk of it be like this one joke idea that you had and like have like that be the bulk of the episode. And then to see like the head writer and Hassan just kind of like be like, nah, and like cut it. That does hurt. Like that did hurt at first a lot. But it's necessary. I'm just like very calloused now. I guess I am trying to say, like, I don't know. Like you get so used to it that things start making it on the show. And you like, it feels amazing because you expect nothing to work, you know? You get become so cynical that when anything works that you're like, oh my God, this is a huge victory for my creativity, which is very rewarding. Like, I don't know. I think being hypercritical and hypercynical is like really important, especially in comedy, because so much of comedy is bombing, you know?
You know what? Like, it's funny because I do want to just clarify the only reason why I was bringing up that iterative process question before is because I gotta clarify here. Is because I think a lot of people see like late night shows and, you know, things like John Oliver, Daily Show or whatever, and they think, oh, you know, teams like probably spent like a day on this, put it together and it's good to go. But like getting a chance to see that very first episode of Patriot Act go through that process and like you mentioned, like it takes months and months of research and like production and writing and rewriting to produce one episode. Like I think that's something that people don't recognize, right? Is that there's so much like mountains of work that goes into even one 25-minute segment. So
totally. it's kind of crazy how many people are involved and how many like feelings are involved, and so many people have different thoughts on it and emotions on it. It's just such a, it's a like a just a bubbling chaotic stew to make one of these episodes.
Yeah.
I don't know why was a gross analogy.
You thought it was gross?
Yeah, I don't like the mental image I got of a bubbling stew. Just wasn't appetizing.
Stew, it's delicious.
Stew's great.
Like stew, like the bubbling stew somehow, like just not into it.
All right. Well, good luck ever eating a stew. I'm pretty sure they all bubble when you boil them. They have to be boiled, right?
Bubbled at some point for sure.
Exactly. I think bubbling is a part of the process.
The process. You're right. I just need to learn to appreciate the process.
I have a question for you guys. You guys are Muslims and you're in media and you're caring about these issues of Muslims in entertainment. Have you guys been following the Dua Gate?
Which one? Like the Hassan one?
Yeah.
Like Hassan's issue with the calling out people for making dua in the thing. I didn't realize it was like an actual thing. I think because I saw his follow-up interview with the DA and he mentioned it. I didn't realize it was like an actual big thing. Was he actually getting like a legit pushback?
I actually don't think so. That's why I'm asking you guys, because
no, I mean, I just assumed it was like a bit. I thought it was a bit. Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I think people's reaction to the actual dua he did with Keith Ellison is what people were actually more offended by.
Yeah, that was hilarious. I thought that was so funny. Good.
Really? Oh my god!
I
pitched
it.
I pitched it.
Amazing.
It was my idea.
10 out of 10 on that one.
Praying for LTE. That was amazing. Yeah.
So here's the thing. I pitched it, and I pitched it to be like a little bit less like overt than the way that he ended up performing it and writing it. But I just thought it'd be funny. And then like it came out and I like didn't watch it. And then I suddenly saw on Facebook like a huge post about it, about some guy calling him like, you know, this is utter blasphemy of the highest regard, like people like really shitting on this bit that I just like wrote in Google Docs that I like didn't think they would do, and then they ended up doing it, and now the entire, you know, Facebook Oma is mad at me. But anyway.
I mean, honestly, like people are gonna make noise all the time. Like that's something that we learned with the Oscars a long time ago too. Mm-hmm. It's like no matter what you do, you're always gonna have people who have their own strong opinion. You know, we hosted. Right. Have you ever heard of this cartoon called Bilal? It was like an animated film that was like produced in the Middle East, but like actually had a pretty good cast. Anyway, long story short, we screened it here in Edmonton and we were like the only people to do that. And we had like a sold out audience, like 600-700 people. And it was literally about like, you know, Hazrat Bilal, like the, you know, one of the companions of the Prophet, the first person to do Adhan, you know, so on and so forth. And like all these people started hating on us afterwards, being like, oh, they barely talk about Islam in this movie. How dare this person call himself Muslim? Like people are always going to find things to hate on. And, you know, at the end of the day, like if you're not able to look at things within the context in which they're being delivered, then like that's not, I don't know, that's not on you, man. Like that's
right.
That's got to be something that people need to be better at. But I do want to ask you about that episode. Sana just chimed in saying Muslim Karens out there. completely agree.
Karen got on, with a Q. Got on,
yeah, exactly. no, but I do want to ask you about that BLM episode that you guys did, because I think it was very important, especially within like the South Asian community, but I'm assuming also within the Arab community, it's something that is often not talked about enough. Can you tell us a little bit about why you guys thought it was so important to call out those specific ethnic groups, like our own ethnic groups, if you will, or was that something that Hassan felt particularly strong about, or tell us a little bit about that?
I mean, this isn't going to be an exciting answer, but because we didn't write, we didn't work on it. That was really just Hassan and the head writer. He consulted me on it for some of the like the Muslim takes that, like, you know, with regard to like the dua thing. Initially he was gonna say no more dua, we need to blah 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 blah, and I was like, hey, you can't say no more dua, like, you can say you can't just do dua, that's fine, but no more dua is like actually gonna offend people, like legitimately. Mm-hmm. To tell them not to pray, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But other than that, I didn't have too much say in what ended up getting shot. It was really just made for YouTube.
Right.
I don't know if you, it's like 7 minutes long. It's not a huge thing, but it took off and they ended up putting it on Netflix, which is really goes to show how kind of like finicky like Netflix is. Like if something is popular, they'll just kind of throw it up on the major platform, right? Like it kind of is just, this is a Hassan's joke, but it is just like a glorified YouTube page in a weird way. It like gets legitimacy just because there's a big N when you click it. But yeah, I thought it was really good. I thought he performed it really well. He was really intense. And I think those issues are really brutal. Like the problem of racism in the Muslim community. It's like, mm-hmm. it's so sad. Just because we really do think of ourselves as like just beyond race, you know, like Muslims mm-hmm. are kind of the ultimate colorblind, quote unquote, kind of community. Like, and just because of Bilal radiallahu anhu, like we just think that, well, we had a black guy involved in the first part, so we're good. You know what I mean?
But then, box. We're fine. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, our prophet had a black best friend. It's like ultimately, yeah. Basically, that's what we're saying.
We can't be racist.
Yeah, yeah. We can't be racist. Exactly. But then,
sorry. Really go ahead. Sad.
No, I'm just gonna again say that it's just sad that we have such a problem with it. And mm-hmm. we're really averse to talking about it because we feel almost like it's apocryphal to talk about. Because we're like, well, I mean, Bilal, come on. And then, you know, the quote from the final khutbah about, you know, no black man is better than a white and no white is better. Like, we kind of just like lean on those two pretty heavily in the absence of actual like addressing like racial mm-hmm. problems, you know.
Yeah.
It's really fucked up how ubiquitous it is. Like, it really is. You don't even think about it. Like, my Syrian grandma will just, like, say some really colorist shit, and you just go, like, you just, like, nod. Just because it's easier than
being a good conversation. Yeah,
exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
But I think that was something that was so wonderful about that episode is, like, it addressed colorism and anti-blackness within the Desi community specifically, but also others in the Muslim community, like, so well that it was, like, you can't – I think it opened the door for a lot of people to be able to have those conversations. Like, I know that video clip was circulating. We talk about the auntie WhatsApp chats here all the time, but it was, like, definitely in there. And, like, people were talking about it, and I really do think that was, like, a really – necessary and wonderful thing that was done by the team because I think it opened the door for a lot of those conversations.
It definitely did. I think it's interesting because I also got some people who like were pushing back on it, being like, oh well, you know, white people want to tan, so why is it such a big deal that I want to become more fair? And it's like, you're kind of missing the point a little bit, right? Like, you know, that's not exactly what's being talked about over here. But yeah, I don't know, man. We got a long ways to go still, but we'll get there, inshallah.
Yeah, we'll get there.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
So I'm going to pull this transition out of thin air. But Ismail, please tell us about your mustache.
going with. Yikes.
Is it like a big part of your identity? Like I have so many questions.
I don't know. I mean,
It looks
Thank you so much, man. I need to hear the
constant
praise. Thank you very much.
I feel like a lot of guys tried jumping on the mustache trend, me included, in the middle of, in like the beginning of the quarantine. It was like, well, I'm at home. Like nobody's going to see me. Let me try it out. But you are an OG mustache wearer. So respect. Respect.
Dude, thank you so much to both of you. I truly appreciate it. I thank God for it every day. No, you know, it's funny to think of people as seeing me with it and like kind of pinning me to it, because I've always seen my mustache as like a weird bit of makeup to make me not look like a child. Like, I feel like people don't know that without it, I look literally like I'm 19, maybe. Like, I look really little without a mustache, or without any facial hair. I look like a baby boy. So I just did it to mark that I had like grown a little bit, you know what I mean? Just for my own sense of sanity. I guess for that reason, it's a part of my identity. It's preventing me from losing my mind.
Love it. I love it. Okay. So let me preface this part by for our listeners, letting them in on a little secret, on a sad secret, if you will. Ismail was actually supposed to be the host of this year's Moscars, which unfortunately has been postponed due to COVID. So we are still very hopeful that we're going to be able to make that happen, inshallah, next year. But what is next for you? What are you working on right now? Or is Patriot Act like all consuming?
Well, right now Patriot Act is off. We're actually done doing episodes and we're waiting for a second season.
Or like a sixth
season. This has all been one season. These episodes, 38 like, episodes or whatever.
Really?
Whoa. Yeah,
it was one season order that they ordered 2 years ago. So season one is officially over. And we're waiting on season two, and you know, COVID really messed things up for me. I mean, obviously for everybody, but I was planning on, you know, going around pitching ideas to different networks and stuff for shows, and you know, trying to see what I could do with myself prior to this. But it kind of, I mean, I don't know. I've been lost. Everything because of COVID. I don't know. I hate being such a bummer, but I'm just like working on packets right now to try to get another job in the event that we don't get picked up. I don't know. Go ahead.
And I was just going to say, I would probably assume anyway that you guys are probably safe to get renewed, but who knows these days? I don't know.
Right.
Not to jinx it. Inshallah. You guys later,
man.
Gotta add that IA, you know.
can I ask you what do other people say on the podcast when
like
you ask
what's
them, like,
next what's for next, them? I mean,
what's next for you in the midst of this, you know, pandemic that's ruined you know everything?
Yeah, straight up. I mean, a lot of people are still kind of trying to keep creative skills sharp by writing, or like you said, trying to get pitches out there. But if you're an actor or in like a show, like we just had Hamza Haq on, who I don't know if you're familiar with him, but Hamza's he's on the number one show in Canada right now. It's called Transplant. It actually just got picked up by NBC, and he's in that same world where they're in between seasons, uncertainty as to like when they're going to start filming again. So they just recently got renewed, but you know, he's working on short films and doing things that he can do just to stay sharp. But yeah, you're right. I mean, like so many other industries, the creative space, especially around film, is like very much, I would assume, at a standstill right now. So
yeah,
it's probably really trippy.
It's very trippy, and I don't know. I'm just hoping for a vaccine, man. I'm just hoping that
straight up
that things kind of like can somehow get back to normal. Because a part of me is like trying to come to terms with just in case. I'm trying to ready myself mentally for a world where like there is no more stand up. And like, I just have to like become a bricklayer in upper, you know, just somewhere in Massachusetts or some shit. Just like,
wait,
be a guy.
Are you doing any digital sets? Like, is that
stepping on my questions here?
Oh, I'm sorry. you gotta jump in with that timing.
Listen, Scudder's always quicker because he likes interrupting people more than I do. But I was gonna say, like, so we know, like, we've had a few other comedians on who have done sets over Zoom and stuff, and obviously world of difference between doing it in front of a live audience in person. But like, have you tried that, or like, is that something that you're interested in trying?
I have not tried it, and my interest in it. No, I'm not interested in it. I'm trying to think of a way to like say it.
Just say no.
To leave it. I just want to leave the possibility. We're not pitching you, by the way. No, yeah, guys, I'm not going to do your show. I'm not
going to
do it.
Come on, no, no, no. Man.
It's. Oh shit! Can you hear me?
Yeah.
My AirPods are just making weird noises. They keep like sounding like they're dying. But I was gonna say. It's not the same experience. Stand-up is so specific. Doing it in front of a crowd is the only reason to do it. It's you want to get those actual laughs. Otherwise, yeah. It's like just tweet, and I don't like tweeting either. So, you know what I mean? Like, and fair the enough, number of shows enough. I've seen that have been performed on Zoom, where like the next day they have to like release like a apology to people. Where they're like, we're so sorry that you know. Nazi face 69, you know, usurped the Zoom chat and started writing the N-word a bunch. Like, you're so sorry to everybody who was triggered. Like, they just sound like chaos. They don't sound fun.
Fair enough.
It's hard, man. It's hard. Like, I honestly feel for comedians who are having to do that. Like, not, you know, they're I'm sure they're doing it because they want to do it as well. But like, without getting that immediacy of like response of mm-hmm. like a laugh or being able to like know that your joke has landed because everybody's on mute on a Zoom call. Like, that's gonna be just tough.
Looking good. At the squares to see some people. Like, are people smiling? What's happening?
But, good God. Yeah, I would be way more open to just like putting a box on a street corner and like telling jokes like a you know, old timey prophet or whatever.
Oh,
you know
my
what
God,
I mean?
That'd be amazing.
That would be so you much better.
Do that, record it, and put that on YouTube.
100%. That would be amazing.
Okay. We are approaching an hour, so we're gonna start wrapping this up. But before we let you go, we have a couple of quick rapid fire questions for you.
Okay.
So, no thought required. Just first thing that comes to your mind, no right or wrong answers unless you give us a wrong answer, in which we'll let you know that's a wrong answer. Okay. Number one, who's your dream collab?
Ooh, you don't want me to think?
Don't, just whatever comes to mind.
Jake Gyllenhaal.
All right, love it.
Ooh, good choice. Good choice.
I don't know what we'd do together.
I know, I was like not expecting it to be him, but I'm very impressed.
It's really, like a buddy cop movie, I feel.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that project. Please make that a reality. Okay, who's your fave comedian?
Or comedy or, special.
Or comedy special or both.
My favorite comedy special, Ronnie Chang, put out a special.
Good choice.
I forgot its name already, but
yeah,
I remember
like
watching it
on Netflix, right?
Yes, it's so good. It's really funny, and just it's like what I want to do with the special. You know what I mean? It's so funny, and it like you learn shit about like Chinese, like the language. Like he's like so informative in it, and it's just as funny as if it was like. Not at all informative. Like,
I loved it. That was
what
so
I
good.
Want to do. I want love to it. Do
laugh and learn together.
Yeah, exactly. Knowing that you're learning. That's what I love.
Yeah, nice.
Like iterative. Okay. Number three.
Oh wow.
what's the most binge? What? Go ahead.
My right AirPod is dead, so I don't know if that's messing with the audio. I just want to let you guys.
You sound fine. You sound fine.
Okay.
Okay. Number three, what's the most binge-worthy show on any streaming platform right now? You're allowed to do a shameless plug here if you want.
well, I'm not going to do that.
Besides Patriot Act, but keep going.
Sure. Besides Patriot Act and Hasan Minhaj. I think Search Party. I don't know how you watch it. Maybe Amazon Prime. That's why I'm watching it. I don't know if there's
Search
another way
Party?
To do it. Search Party, really good, really funny, bingy, and just great. Like, yeah, it's great. It's with Alia Shelkat from Arrested Development. Yeah,
Okay,
love it. Yeah,
cool. And then, last but not least, what is your favorite kind of potato?
Ooh, russet.
Okay, I appreciate that, but we made this style of eating like mashed or fries or waffle fries. Oh. Or like... But Russets are top dog potatoes.
Russets are great. They are. Wait, okay. This question. All right. What's my favorite kind of potato? I mean, a potato in like a curry is good, like in a what's it called, in like a Thai curry, like a Penang maybe. That's okay. A good kind of potato. Yeah. Okay. Also russets in any form are good. Yeah.
All right. Do you amazing. Like check with kitchens at restaurants, are you like, are these russets or
yes, that's me exactly. I'm okay with whether, I don't care if the chicken was free range, I want to know if it's russet.
Yeah. The potatoes like, russet
is this, yeah.
Amazing. So good. Okay. On that note, Ismail, thank you so much for your time, man. We really, really appreciate you coming and spending some time with us. Where can people find you? How can people see your stuff?
Instagram. I've been bad about it, but I'm gonna start posting again, inshallah, soon. I'm gonna try to post clips and stuff. But yeah, Instagram, Ismail Y Lutfi. ISMAELYLOUTFI. That's my name. Nice. Boom, baby.
Don't you forget it.
All right. Y'all forget it.
Amazing.
Also, and congratulations. Oh. You mentioned earlier this year you got married.
Yes.
Congratulations on that.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah. Is it that we're done? I won't ask more questions. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Is like roaming the streets right now, trying to give him some time.
Yeah.
All right. We won't keep her out anymore. Okay. All right, man. Thank you again so much.
Of course. Thank you. This was really fun.
Okay.
Awesome.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
Thank you so much for joining us for today's episode of The Halal Gap. You can find us online by searching Mosker's Film Festival on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Thank you so much. We'll talk to you next time.
We'll speak at you next time.
We'll be in your ears next time.
All right. Thank you, Sana.
Thanks, Sana.
You're welcome.